another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, welcome back to another great edition of the NIDS View. I am here today with Jim Petrosky, and only Jim Petrosky. Adam Lowther is out on assignment today. It just seems like we cannot get all three of us together, Jim. I don't know what's going on here. I'm the only one that's consistently here, so I know it's not me.
Well, Curtis, I just say that, you know, it reminds me of a song from back in my teenage years. Just the two of us.
Just the two of us. Okay. Anyway. We'll spare our listeners any solos or karaoke. Hey, we're going to take a little – since Adam's not with us, you know, he completely really eschews science and technology. He's a bit of a Cro-Magnon man when we think about all these sorts of things. And he's much more into the political theory, the international relations theory, and all of those things that make him so brilliant. And so since he's on hiatus for the week, we thought, this is a great time for the audience to listen to science and techie stuff. And so we're going to delve into a little something that Jim and I have been talking about for a while. And we thought, well, this is a great opportunity to discuss this particular topic, and that is this idea of microreactors and how they might be sources of localized power for military bases in support of a number of different things. And one of the things that to make the connection here for our listeners, Jim, is that resilience is one of the key factors of deterrence, right? And that is the ability to make sure that your adversary can't take you out in a lot of its things. And the theory goes is that an adversary that might seek to go first, launch a first strike upon us, they will do different things in theory. They will use EMP attacks to take out our electrical grid or cyber attacks to do the same. There's a potential for kinetic attacks and sabotage within the country's energy grids and these sorts of things. And even on the larger scale that left of the boom in the peacetime world, energy resilience, energy independence, whether you produce it or you have sustainable access to energy at market prices are key aspects to global stability. And when you're in these situations where energy is becoming more expensive or something that you can't count on as much, being able to generate it yourself locally has a tremendous amount of value. And so the Pentagon and industry have been working on a number of these capabilities. I call these micro reactors. Jim, take a minute here. And first of all, welcome to your podcast. It's good to see. I know you're on vacation. You spent some time. I think we talked about in a past one here, but you were going to study the thermodynamics of whale watching. But here you are. Tell us about your experience up there in Alaska.
Yeah, Curtis. Well, I'm really glad to be back here. Yes, I took a vacation in one of my favorite places in the world, and that's the little state of Alaska. You know, that little corner,
that little state
that you see on your map up in the corner. And that's what brought this topic to mind because it came out while I was on vacation. It was nice taking a vacation. For those on the YouTube channel, you can see my Seward, Alaska hat I'm wearing. And I agree, you know, unless you've been living under like a rock or whatever, there's a whole lot of topics we could be talking about today. But I'm glad we're going to, you know, take a little break and talk about something that's new, that's connected to my vacation time. Something that we've been putting off. You remember, Curtis, we've talked about this probably for the past 6 or 7 months, and we just can't find a time to put in it because there's so many other things happening in the world.
Oh, my gosh. And the geopolitical world just moves at such a fast pace.
But just so our listeners know, we will be talking about Iran's nuclear capabilities on future podcasts. I'm sure we're going to hit this on other of our NIDS products and the HUSI seminars, our global security review articles, our reports that we publish at NIDS. I think I've made a good enough shameless plug for all the other things we're doing.
There you go.
I can feel comfortable. Take a little break from that on something that I think we at NIDS, in fact, I've, as a president, I know we're going to begin talking more and more about, and that is energy resilience. But before I do that, let me talk a little bit about Alaska, because it becomes important to this paper and the fact that they're going to put a reactor in Alaska for a couple reasons. But if you're not familiar with Alaska, it is absolutely beautiful, vast open areas, incredible. And it's very strategically important because where it is on the globe, okay, it's on the northern side. You got to get over top of the northern, you know, North Pole. It's one of the closest places to, you know, Russia that we have. You know, just a land bridge there, an island in the middle is really close. Great ecosystem, lots of animals. They have all kinds of things that are different. They have permafrost up there. They have glaciers. I went and saw glaciers. They have the greatest fishing in the world. By the way, look at my hat, Alaska Seward. I just want to mention to our audience, I caught the biggest fish on our boat. I got my king salmon. I got my halibut. So it was all good. But Alaska is unique in other ways in that you get these terrible temperature extremes. For example, you know, they're doing this in Eielson. So you get in the 90s during the summer, minus 60 in the wintertime. And this causes some issues with things that are happening up there. So it's sort of a little background on Alaska. As we talk about this energy resilience, there's a need. Alaska promotes a need for a place. As I used to say when I lived in Alaska, if you really are mean to your neighbors, be careful when the power goes out in Alaska, because you may depend on your life and your neighbors to survive, because things can be brutal. So power is important in Alaska and anywhere we are. So there you go.
Well, I would say power is important everywhere, yeah. And I appreciate that description. Is it true that the Alaska state bird is the mosquito?
No.
Okay.
The mosquitoes are so big. So unlike here in Ohio, if a mosquito lands on your shoulder in Ohio, you don't know it's there until it bites you. But if you're in Alaska and a mosquito lands on your shoulder, you'll trip and fall from the weight and you just shove him off. So that's the difference.
All right. So before we get started here, let me ask you, Jim, can you explain to our listeners and our viewers, what's a microreactor? What are we talking about here?
Okay, yeah. So the interesting thing about a microreactor is they're obviously smaller nuclear reactors. There's a lot of details related to smaller nuclear reactors. So a microreactor, typically 1-to-megawatt reactors, they have a very, very small footprint. For those of you not used to dealing with megawatts in terms of reactors, in electrical power generation terms, I think the smallest U.S. electrical generating nuclear reactor is in New York, is about 600 megawatts. Okay. And then like the Palo Verde reactors, they're about 1,000 megawatts. Okay, that's just 600 to 1,000 megawatts electric. The reactors that are microreactors are typically between 1 and 10 megawatts. There's no specific number for that, but that's the sort of the place where it fits into small. And small means a lot of things. Small means that they're going to be valuable. Small means they have a very small footprint. They have a very small core, so they take very, very little fuel. But, you know, when you think about accidents or anything else, they also have a small radioactive inventory. So that means in an accident scenario or whatever, there's less stuff to be polluting other places than the larger reactors. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. So most microreactors are, because they need to be small, they're of what's called the Gen 4 design. Most of those designs, rather than using a large pressure container that can that has water in it as a moderator. Typically, they're fast reactors, and they typically use a different kind of a fuel that can take higher temperatures. And they use gases instead of under pressure. They use gases that aren't under pressure, and they heat them up, and they use that heat to drive a turbine. And then once you get to the electrical side of this, it's the same thing as anything else, whether it's a gas reactor or a, you know, a gas-powered electrical plant or coal plant or oil plant. They're all the same. You get them to a generator, and once you start putting steam in that generator, then it's all the same. But the small reactors typically are just generating heat. That heat moves around. It heats up a water. People jokingly say nuclear reactors are basically making coffee. We're boiling water. And so we boil water, and that boil turns to steam, and the steam is what provides the energy. It's what turns the turbine and then turns back into water. You take the energy out of it, it turns back to water, and then you regenerate that steam. So that's sort of the idea behind the small reactors. Now, the modular reactors are slightly different than the than other reactors, and you can sort of add and subtract reactors as you need them. They're typically built, and I know the Army's, you know, working on a project right now in which they're building a series of small reactors in which you can just add and subtract to get the power requirements you want. Plus, if they're modular and one, you know, one goes down or you need to refuel one, you just put another one in its place and you pull it out. And so it becomes plug and play. And, you know, there's all kinds of different schemes and ideas of how you could take all the fueling, leave it all intact, pick it up, put it in a truck, drive it somewhere else, repackage it, refuel it, and put it back in another place. And so it becomes extremely valuable from a shutdown standpoint. So there's a lot of reactor things, but it's up to you where you want to head with this, Curtis, but a lot of things with nuclear reactors are based on the fact that this fits into the resiliency, is that nuclear reactors, and this is why they're good for submarines, you don't have to put fuel in them every hour. In fact,
that's right.
Okay, you don't have to keep refueling. You know, submarines have to come to the top, you know, and get refueled if they're based on oil. But a nuclear reactor can run for long periods of time. Some reactors, I think submarines, that can be, you know, fueled for 20 years at a time. So technically, they run without being refueled for 20 years. And these small reactors, typically on a two-year basis, some of the bigger electrical reactors are, you know, 3 and 4 years. And there's a long maintenance time when you bring them down because of the radioactive inventory, because of the materials, because, you know, other features with building a nuclear reactor. It takes a long time to refuel. So you want a long time without putting fuel in, then you shut them down, you refuel them, you know, for a period of time, a couple months, and then you bring them back online. And so there's good from a resilience standpoint in that if you cut off my fuel today, I got 2 years to get you back. Okay. All right. Whereas if you cut off my gasoline or oil today, good luck. Okay. Because I'm burning that fuel today.
Right.
There you go.
So, well, I think that's one of the things that's great about this is that, you know, most bases have generator backup, right? Mm-hmm. And they're generally diesel generators. There are some bases that have some solar power and they have limitations, obviously. The sun only shines certain times of the day and definitely mm-hmm. doesn't shine at night. The challenge of keeping your diesel generators operational, keeping the fuel fresh, you know, making sure that in a time of crisis that you can get them refueled, and so forth. These are all challenges that seem to sort of get overcome, by these micro reactors. One of the things that I found interesting, Jim, in my research, there's a couple of bases. Fort Knox, for example, has acres set aside with solar panels, and they generate a lot of power on the base there using excess space. I think Edwards Air Force Base out in California does something similar. Generally, you can get about a megawatt worth of solar power in about 5 acres. So across 5 acres, you got to put a bunch of glass out there, right? And get, you know, clean solar energy for certain parts of the day, right? But it takes about 5 acres to get 1 megawatt. And, you know, for example, this Army thing you were talking about, the Army version here, Project Pele, which is a small Ryker reactor that's supposed to be about, they say 1 to 5 megawatts mm-hmm. Of power. They sit in, they're modular. They're in Connex crates. They could be put, you know, travel by truck. It basically takes three of them, right? You got the reactor itself, then you have the power conversion distribution unit on another, and then its support and auxiliary systems, its air conditioning, other, you know, these cooling systems and whatnot, all sorts of things. It's really about a 3-to-1. And so simple math tells us that I can fit about 225 of these Pele units in the same acreage of this one solar farm. You just do the math, right? So 225 times 5, I mean, you're getting into the terawatt, I think, right? Isn't that what's one higher than megawatt?
Yeah.
You're getting into the terawatt type thing for the same amount of square footage, if you will. So this is a tremendous, I think, improvement on ROI with regard to available space. And the ability, and for those out there, I think 1 megawatt per hour generates enough power for 1,000 homes, something like that.
Yeah, that's about right.
Roughly about 1,000 homes. So obviously, at 5 megawatts, 5,000 homes, you translate that into buildings and facilities on a military base. You're pretty much able to keep things running with a constant power load for several years, with very little maintenance and almost no risk.
Yeah, I'm not sure about maintenance. We can talk a little bit about risk here in a few minutes, but it all depends on the design. No, I don't disagree with you, but I do think we need to consider these things. In fact, let me back up a little bit to my discussions on Alaska, because I think it's relevant here, and it sort of ties in with our other piece about nuclear weapons. And I don't like to conflate too often nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors, but the reality is there are a lot of places where we can think of these together. And back in the 1950s and 1960s, there's a program called Plowshares, in which we were interested in using nuclear weapons for civil purposes. And in Plowshares, we looked at mining, we looked at port construction, and there actually was Edward Teller wanted to use to build another canal beside the Panama Canal, one in which we wouldn't need locks, using nuclear weapons and a series of them to build a secondary canal. And that was all part of the Plowshares program. And one of the places they looked to do this was a remote place called Alaska, because it's remote, it's pristine, we can do anything we want, there are not a lot of people living there. But there was a lot of pushback against that, setting off a nuclear weapon to build a port. I think it was a Point Hope, if I'm not mistaken. And the whole project was scrubbed. So my point is, it was scrubbed because Alaska has a history of having its pristine view being looked at as a place to do testing and analysis. And we even had further, again, I don't want to put into the negatives here, we're going to get to the positives, but also at Camp Greeley, we actually had a reactor, SM-1A, I believe is what it was called, an Army reactor, that still today has problems because they had leakage of material onto the ground and into the soils. There's dozens of connexes up there filled with dirt that's radioactive. We don't know what to do with and dispose of it. So there are risks associated with nuclear reactors.
Are we talking about technology from the 60s?
Well, it wasn't a technologies issue as much as the issue in Alaska. But I'll get to it here. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that regulation and oversight sort of fell to the wayside. At the time, we had an Army Oversight Board, and they did the siting and everything else, and that sort of fell apart. We took it apart, and now we didn't have the oversight that we needed. That was part of it. And then part of it was the cruel, cruel weather of Alaska caused pipes to freeze and material to degenerate. We had leaks and such. And so there's my point, though, is that there's nothing that's risk-free. However, let's look at the benefits of something of this nature. I mean, we've looked, you know, there's been recent work that's been done looking at, you know, the need for power. The one is resilience, and a very important one I want to get back to. But, you know, we're looking at power for data centers that are data hogs. They're going to increase. Some of these are going to be megawatt usage data centers storing data for AI, et cetera. They have to have power. It's got to come from somewhere. Okay. Water treatment, desalination. You want to talk about populations needing water and, you know, being able to grow crops. Nuclear reactors can be used. The power from the heat from that can be used to desalinate water in a very, very inefficient way. Imagine that for a country or for a region that doesn't have its own water source.
You said inefficient. You mean in an efficient way.
In an efficient. Yes. I don't want my audience to misunderstand. In an efficient way. I get excited. So I started just skipping words.
I want to make sure.
No. Very good. Thank you for correcting me. No. And for other industrial purposes, as we begin to build new materials and high temperature materials. And so all those up front, you know, I'm saying that there are many, many uses for nuclear fuels that add to our economy, to our ability to do it ourselves, to survive when other things have gone on, that nuclear can provide us that ability. And in, you think of the United States, you talked about EMP, think about the United States, we have these three primary power grids that operate independently, mm-hmm. sort of the Texas one in between, and the Eastern one is also, by the way, part of Canada. If you want to go back to January and remember all the fussing with Canada saying, oh, well, we'll just cut off your power. How do you like that kind of leverage on the United States? So, I imagine a world where we would have small reactors in every state. Now, if you want to take out the United States power grid, good luck. You're going to have to take all 50 of them or all 52 or whatever someone said recently in a stupid podcast. Anyway, you want to take out all 50 of our power grids, okay? And these small reactors are really good. But here's the piece that I think that, you know, when you look back at our previous lessons learned, we learned a lesson in Greeley. We learned a lesson in Three Mile Island. We learned a lesson in Fukushima. We've changed designs, new technology. We've changed operations. We've learned how to site better. And here's the interesting thing about these newer generations reactors, especially small ones. They can be put underground. You can put one of these underground. Now you talk about, you know, the ability to keep the environment safe, the potential for, you know, a population exposures. You look at terrorist potentials, they're gone. You look at, sabotage, that goes away. You have limited access. All of these things happen. These small reactors do a great job of doing that. And then if you have a modular where you can pull them out and put them in, you have a safe and secure place to refuel away from the reactor community. So these are very, very good ideas using our technology and our ingenuity and our innovation to, instead of running scared because something may have happened in the past, we say, you know, we learned from that. We know what's better. Now let's take a look at it. And that's the way I view all of these issues.
Well, I think this is a common, I don't know, problem in the deterrence world. We measure nuclear risks, whether they be weapons or reactors, based on historical precedent that's 40 plus years old when technology was older and not nearly as refined as it is today. We just know so much more about, you know, the material and the physics of it all and so forth and so on to make it all so much more useful, whether you're talking space or underground all, and everything in between. And I think that's one of the things that's tremendous. And we should think about the value of these things. You know, if we were to have a system, as you described, Jim, where we have these micro reactors, you know, to supplement city consumption, neighborhood consumption, obviously isolated rural areas that bring them up to speed and power, and then certainly military bases and military functions that need lots of power to run command centers and airfields and all these sorts of things, nuclear launch facilities, and so forth. You know, one of the things that these things can do is, they strengthen deterrence by having this capability because they begin to deny adversaries leverage against us, right? Because they make us less vulnerable, right, to attack, to coercion, to energy prices, to market accessibility. If when you think about it, you're denying environmental leverage, right? The wind doesn't blow, it doesn't matter, right? The sun doesn't shine, it doesn't matter. These things still work. And so I guess the only limitation might be is your access to, you know, the material, right? With the uranium or whatever it is that you're using to create the material. The second thing here to think about is the ensuring is that it helps to ensure operational continuity. This ability to have energy flowing constantly at constant rates that's much more dependable. It makes your electronic systems more stable. You can guarantee your continuity of operations. The airfield will always be open. We don't suffer brownouts and these other sorts of things like some states do. Because of access to the bigger grid. And I think the third thing here is that it enhances our strategic autonomy. And I would add in that our strategic resilience. And that is the ability to reduce dependencies that can then be exploited against us, right? So there was a period of time in our recent history, say 15, 20 years ago, when we were not producing enough oil in America, and we depended on oil exports to get to the United States. And so then what we had is countries that hated us that would then decide whether or not they were going to sell oil to us and then use that to coerce us, to shape our behavior in their need. These idea, no blood for oil, right? We're not going to fight wars in the Persian Gulf over oil and so forth and so on. And one of the greatest things when we think about fossil fuels, Jim, one of the greatest liberators to America's national security was, of all things, fracking.
Yep.
Because it made America energy independent under the first Trump administration. We became an oil exporter for the first time in I don't know, memorable history anyway. What happened then is that the price of oil dropped. Now you defang Putin and his ability to support his wars. And you lower the price of energy, oil, fossil fuel energy anyway, so that Americans can drive the kind of car they want to drive and enjoy whatever it is they need to do in that regard. And this also, in the resilience side, this removes your risk to the cascading effects, right, of damage the interconnectedness of the network, of the grid, right? You have one area of the grid go down and all of a sudden, Michigan's dark for a week because they're at the end of the grid. And a lot of, productivity suffers, people lose, stuff, right? Your refrigerators go, you have to throw out all your food. Anybody who's suffered power outages for any long periods of time, it's very disruptive just to your personal life. It can be disruptive to your health, and it is definitely disruptive to commerce and these sorts of things. And then you can certainly think of that into the national security realm and what does that mean. So these micro reactors really begin to sort of have an impact on the bigger geopolitical national security problem set, which is really necking it down as to how you can mitigate those problems by doing something very localized, but I would say in a very a mesh networked way. You can connect these things together. You can create micro, micro networks where you might string a few of them together from community to community to community, and then they can help each other. And these sorts of things. I just think that the limitations are so few. And I think our biggest limitation is, our own fear that is often sort of made up and not being willing to jump into this mechanism with both feet because of what it brings to value. Jim, let me ask you, in a nuclear environment, right, when we think about survivability, resilience, endurability, and recoverability after an attack, can these micro reactors and modular reactors, and especially as we mature them over the next decade or so, do you, can you envision them being, you know, EMP hardened, blast resistant, you know, obviously at some distance? You talked about being able to bury them. I can put them at sea. I can obviously put them on trucks and move them around. How can I, you know, how resilient can I, can, I don't know, physics and money allow me to make these things?
Well, there are a couple things here, and it, you've given me a lot to unpack in a very, very short time that I've got left to do this. But let me hit a couple of these issues. So I'll start with your last one first, and sort of go backwards, and that is on EMP hardening, et cetera. Again, for those who have heard me teach, going underground is always, you know, you put your power lines underground, you put your generation facilities underground, you connect things via underground, because the ground is a great shield to electromagnetic pulse, unless you have, you know, a direct hit and you got, you know, source region EMP. But let's just talk about, reality of large scale electromagnetic pulse. Now, you still can get pathways into the grid, et cetera, and that's why you want a distributed grid. So the physical piece of a nuclear reactor, the fissioning process and the fuels and everything else, totally unaffected by an EMP. Now, the control mechanisms, the monitoring mechanisms, all of the mechanisms for moving the heat from point A to point B.
Those auxiliary systems.
Yeah. All that generation stuff. Yes, that is those SCOTAs that are, you know, the systems that are designed for controls, et cetera. Yes, they are vulnerable. But remember, we're talking small. So protecting something small is easier than trying to protect something big. You know, it's my answer always on the cell phone. When people say, there's an EMP, will my cell phone work? I said, well, if your cell phone's sitting inside of a little metal box inside your house or inside of a metal building, it might, you know, it could easily survive. But the entire power grid can't be stuck inside a box unless we, that's right, you know, build the dome, like a real dome over top of the U.S. I'm not sure we could do that. So my point is, the smaller it is, the easier it is to control, and then you control pathways in, and that's all part of the engineering. So from that standpoint, these small reactors become nicer because they take up less space. And I'm looking at my notes. Yeah. So, you talk about solar farms. So these small reactors with all their auxiliary stuff, 7 acres for like a new scale reactor to, you know, place, which is 77 megawatts electric. Okay. But remember, the nuclear part of that and everything, a lot of that could be built underground. And, and so that's the first piece. So there are challenges there from the EMP standpoint, but they can be overcome by this distribution. And from the modular reactor standpoint, remember that if I lose an entire system, if I build the whole thing modular, then I lose one system that's not protected. I yank it out. I stuck another one in. It's like changing a fuse in your car. Not quite as easy, but you get the idea. That's different than what we have now with these large power systems sitting out in the open, large open transformer, drive around your property, audience, and, you know, go around any local city and look for those big gray towers in the sky, because they are antennas and they're going to pick up what comes down. So that's the first part from the EMP standpoint. Let me back up from the other piece that I think is the difficult part, but it becomes a challenge. But I'm going to say the challenge is going to have a silver lining on it. And that is that we haven't been doing a lot of new nuclear reactor work, and certainly not this area before. Some of the challenges right now, when we had small the stationary modular reactors that the Army had before, we had our Army siting board, et cetera. The NRC is going to have to come up with a process for siting. They're going to have to process for monitoring and oversight. And I know, yeah. I know, you know, people roll their eyes, oh, oversight. You want public opinion to stay with you, you better have good oversight. We've learned our lesson. SM1A is a good example of that. Good oversight, publicly trustable oversight, because the public has to be on board. But that said, you have good oversight. You get, we have to build that into the system. And then you have to site these the right way. They have to be sited. And then you need trained people to operate these reactors. We're talking high temperature gas reactors. We don't have any operational, someone might correct me on this, but last I checked, we don't have any of those type of reactors running in the U.S. Let's see, we had the EBR-1, I think, that went down in 1964, we closed it out. EBR-2, 1994, the FFT, the Fast Flux Test Facility, that was shut down in 2001. Now, worldwide, there are reactors like that. So we got to build a generation of people who know how to operate, manage, monitor, and keep these things operating. But we need to take that challenge because we could take that to the rest of the world. Imagine a country who needs farmland and they can desalinate and we can teach them how, or needs power and we can teach them how and make them more resilient. Make that, right. You know, trade that energy in a different way. Instead of us borrowing energy, we can sell them energy and improve their economy and improve their lifestyle. That's what we should be doing instead of, you know, cowing down and saying, well, we can't do it because, you know, 40 years ago we had a problem. Well,
right.
I had exactly. a lot of problems 40 years ago and I'm 62 right. and I don't do those things anymore. Okay. I learn from them. Okay. And if I continue to do them, then, you know, my life would be rough. So I think that it's time for us to do this. And I'm glad the Air Force is at least considering this to a point where we are, where we're looking at something and becoming the thought leader. And in many ways, from a resilience standpoint, from an energy standpoint, from a use of our capabilities and innovation standpoint. And I think the world would be better off for it. Now, there are naysayers who say, well, yeah, but what about the big nuclear accident? Everything else. Everything comes with a risk. I get out of bed in the morning, I have a risk. Let's weigh that risk against the benefits. And the benefits here are that we can deter a nuclear attack by being more resilient because we're not vulnerable. We can remove, you know, the ambitions of other countries who hold a hammer over our head because of power and energy. I mean, energy is the future. I mean, I've seen Mad Max. Energy is the future. Okay? And so, you know, you either have it or you don't. And if you don't have it, you're going to be fighting for it. If you do have it, you're going to be defending it. Let's get to the point where we have it and we can use it to our benefit.
Well, that's fantastic. I hope that our listeners have gained a little confidence in the potentiality for microreactors and certainly what it means to the deterrence mindset, the mitigation of risk in that sort of thing. And the idea in the deterrence by resilience approach is to make the adversary realize that they can't prevent the response. They can't prevent the adversary, us, from reacting and retaliating by certainly shutting off the lifeblood of the defense, which is its power.
Yep.
And its ability to function in that regard. Well, that's good. We have come to our time here as the commuters are returning home now. And so, again, I want to thank you, Jim, for sharing your expertise with the audience here on microreactors. And I'm certainly a lot smarter on this. And really, I'm looking forward to thinking more about this. And some more of the work that we're going to do on this, I think, as time moves forward. So thank you for that. Again, I want to thank you, the listener, for spending 35 minutes or so with us. We really do appreciate it. Check us out on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. If you're interested in reading some cool stuff, hit us up on globalsecurityreview.com. We've got articles coming out almost every day. We have a number of different events that have occurred here over the last week with Real Space Strategy and Chris Stone and some other events upcoming with us. And for those of you who are in the greater Kansas City, Missouri area, I want you to think about we have an event coming up in the near future on August 6th at the Truman Library where we will, note the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs, and we'll have some speakers and we'll talk about the relevance of that, and of course the value of the deterrence that was built from that over the last 80 years. So, highly encourage you to consider if you've got the time, would like to attend that. Hit us up on our website and register for those. The seating is limited. It is free, but seating is limited. Again, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you and all that you do as supporters of NIDS. And without you, this show would not happen and this organization would not exist. So thank you very much. And Jim and I will leave you here today with a reminder to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
It's Podcasting Network.